This week on Your Western Context, Alberta continues to implement democratic reform. The Royal BC Museum is decolonizing its exhibits, and the Canadian flag will emulate a yo-yo over the next week. Also, we discuss the impacts of the COP26 summit as Trudeau continues to hobble oil and gas. This is Western Context, episode 243, recorded Friday, November 5th, 2021. Unsettling. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back, as we are each and every week, and we're going to discuss the news of the week and shed some extra context on it that you might not have found in your regular readings of it.
Yes, some news stories took over the headlines, so to speak, and other news kind of flew in under the radar, so we're going to be talking about a lot that was missed in the coverage of the main stories, and to talk about some of the other stories that didn't really receive any attention, that are nevertheless important to what goes on in Canada.
That's right. We believe a population that has all the information and context with the news is better to make their own decisions. And if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is a podcast about just that. We aim to provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And in doing so, we're going to be removing all the media bias and sensationalism that you find in the news, whether you find it on print, TV, online, anywhere you read it. And it's something we've been doing since January 2017, and we invite you to follow along in our full show notes at westerncontext.ca. And we're going to begin in Alberta this week, because this week has been a huge, busy week in Alberta, with the agriculture minister resigning this Friday due to a scandal involving alcohol. We also have, of course, the resumption, or rather the beginning of the fall session of the legislature. And last Friday, the Alberta government also released the PricewaterhouseCoopers report on policing in Alberta. And this report was put forward after the Fair Deal panel, led by the likes of Preston Manning, amongst others, initiated a review in finding that Alberta should perhaps implement its own provincial police force to take some extra powers back from the federal government, namely in this case the RCMP, and we would do this by not renewing our contract with the RCMP. The RCMP provides policing to rural municipalities, and that's because most larger cities do maintain their own police force, and this strategy, this plan, potential plan, has raised a lot of eyebrows because, put simply, Ontario and Quebec already have their own provincial police forces, so a blueprint already exists within other provinces in terms of how Alberta could do the same. It would cost the province more, as we would lose up to $170 million in federal funding, and we'd need to grow this force from the ground up. But with that increase in cost and the loss in federal funding, response times for policing in the rural areas of the province would decrease, and officers would be from the communities in question rather than from potentially being out of province. Now, most of the media reaction to this is centered on why Alberta shouldn't do this. But at the end of the day, there's already a blueprint that exists, and given the way the UCP has been going, it's likely that Albertans will have the final say in a referendum on this at some point in the future. And this has been talked about in the past, that if this were to happen, it would likely be a referendum that would only be held in areas that would be policed by this new police force. Because if you think about it, somebody living in Edmonton or Calgary doesn't really have the right to tell somebody who lives in rural Alberta how they should be policed. Now, of course, as with all things in Alberta, this will hinge on our democracy, and that's where the fall session of the Alberta legislature started this week, and the UCP continues to tick off its 2019 platform commitments, much to the chagrin of many people out there. This week, Bill 81 was introduced, which will raise election spending limits to be in line with current prices. It will also set a fixed election date and close the so-called AFL, or Alberta Federation of Labour, loophole by prohibiting groups affiliated with political parties from running a registered political action committee. Now, just as a brief reminder, a political action committee is a group of people or an organization that seeks to campaign for a political purpose, helping one political party or another. They aren't political parties themselves. They're just a group of people surrounded by a certain ideology that wants to campaign in one specific way or another. The new funding formula that's set out for funding of political parties would set a funding value of $1.16 per registered voter, which creates a limit of just over $3.27 million to be spent in a campaign, with Alberta having about 2.8 million registered voters. Since the Redford government, Alberta has had a fixed election period, and this new bill would set a fixed election date to be the last Monday in May every 4 years, setting the start of the campaign period as the day the writ is issued, rather than February 1st. And this brings a lot of certainty to Alberta's election period, when in reality, this election period could have been any day from the start of February to the end of May, and this was one of the platform commitments that the UCP ran on in 2019. Alongside this, the number of advanced voting stations will increase to increase accessibility for voters. Now, I'm just going to go back to the AFL loophole, and because we need to talk about that one, because this is actually a big deal. This loophole is simple in that it prevents groups from that are associated with a political party from running a PAC or political action committee. In the past, the Alberta Federation of Labour has had very, very close ties with the NDP, and it's this sort of hand-in-arm relationship that Bill 81 seeks to curtail. Now, for anybody wondering why it's called the AFL loophole, the relationship in question here is that the head of the AFL, Gil McGowan, has run for the federal NDP before, and with the way that the NDP is structured in Canada, if you're a member of the federal NDP and you reside in Alberta, you're also a member of the Alberta NDP, and vice versa, so the two political parties are inherently linked. Under the bill, the chief electoral officer at Elections Alberta would be required to refuse the registration of a third-party advertiser, also known as the Political Action Committee, if its higher-ups were also involved in the decision-making of any political party. It also directs the chief electoral officer to continue the so-called activities of the members of a PAC, including public statements in support of or opposition related to registered political parties or candidates. Now, but most importantly with this bill, another election promise is fulfilled. An annual donation limit of $30,000 for political action committees will be put in place. Previously, the legislation brought in by the NDP only applied this to the election period, leaving an actual loophole. So in theory, as is on the books now and has been since 2015, a political action committee could spend as much as they wanted outside of the election period. Now, this will be capped to a donation limit of $30,000 for political action committees. Now, of course, you're probably wondering, where's the controversy in this story and why is this something that people are against? And what's really rich about this story is that NDP Democracy and Ethics critic Thomas Dang said that the changes in the bill are, in the NDP's words, a dangerous attack on democracy. Now, the NDP this time is concerned that any extra donations received during a nomination race could be donated to constituency associations. The idea that's likely in the NDP's mind in this case is that a grassroots party like the UCP that has open and competitive nominations and draws tons of attention would see candidates run, and those who don't win would have the option of sending any of the extra money directly to the constituency association in question, skirting the new $12,500 up from $10,000 limit for nominated candidates. And the interesting part about this, when you look at this, is that constituency associations are something that not everyday Albertans think about. And the constituency and associations are what effectively runs the ground operation of a political party, both in and out of an election campaign. And by and large part, these constituency associations are strapped for money because they're volunteer organizations. And depending on the organization in that area, some might not even have enough money for the most basics. So the other side of what the NDP is saying on this is that if you look at what actually happens in some constituency associations, say, for example, an NDP constituency association in rural Alberta, if there was a competitive nomination race there, any extra money in that race could be donated to that constituency association to make it hum better along until the next election period comes up. Now, of course, the difference, of course, with this is that the money will come from individual donors and not PACs, corporations, or unions. Dang continued to use inflammatory language, saying that the system, in his own words, will be fundamentally unfair and rigged so that Premier Jason Kenney can steal the next election. Now, for anybody who's been paying attention, these are the exact same words that the media criticized Republicans south of the border for using after the 2020 general election. That rhetoric seems to be fine for the Alberta NDP, though, and media covering the story. For Albertans who voted for the UCP in 2019 and were intrigued by their democratic reform platform, that is now nearly complete, with the biggest items in terms of recall legislation and citizen referenda both pending regulation writing, hence why they haven't been proclaimed. With putting limits on PACs and setting fixed election dates coming into force very soon once Bill 81 passes, the UCP's democratic reform platform commitments will be mostly committed. And with this, it's so very puzzling as to why people are still surprised when the UCP does things that were in their election platform and gets angry with them. Elections have consequences, and that's why it's so important that we pay attention to when changes in our democracy happen, as is happening this week.
Yes, it is interesting to see how the reaction from the NDP is that the UCP are trying to steal the next election and that it's causing the system to be unfair and rigged. You know, as soon as you hear those words, that comes to mind from what Donald Trump had said after the 2020 U.S. presidential election. And it would surprise a lot of people to think that the Alberta NDP are taking notes and tips on how to conduct themselves from the former U.S. president. But here it is, and I think that that's something that a lot of people would be surprised to hear, given what has been going on. But what isn't surprising is that the UCP are continuing to move on with their democratic reform platform, because they've had, for better or for worse, whatever side of the politics fence that you reside on, they have been very good at getting their platform achieved. And the promises that they put in place during the election campaign are now well underway of getting passed and completed and operational. And I think that that's something that most political parties would be very happy with, and certainly most of their supporters would be. And I think that sort of efficiency is something that you'd want to see in other political parties if they actually did what they promised. Because if every political party did what they promised, then it would be very easy to figure out who to vote for, because there wouldn't be any as much deception, there wouldn't be any hidden taxes or hidden agendas that would be out there. And certainly, this is something that a lot of the federal parties could take a look at as to how to conduct themselves.
Yeah, and it's going so very fast, because we're in a period, of course, where the legislature has begun its fall session. And just this week, we're already looking at additional news stories as to things that are going to be further platform commitments from 2019 for the UCP, in particular when it comes to diversification of the economy, when it comes to hydrogen, and also looking at Alberta's sources of rare minerals and rare earths that could be very useful for the next generation of economic growth in the province. And we'll have more on that in the coming weeks. But when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, this is a government that, by and large part, with the exception of the COVID pandemic, has done what it said it was going to do. And you can look across the country and try and find these. There's been a few of them. The NDP here in Alberta in 2015 stuck mostly to their platform. They had some big surprises in there, like the carbon tax and whatnot, and some things they didn't talk about. But lo and behold, finding governments that do what they say in Canada is something that is very rare. And everybody listening outside of the province should definitely open up an eye on this, because this is a huge story, and it's going to change the way the province works here in Alberta when it comes to democracy. But of course, we also have to talk about what's happening in BC in relation to the BC Premier and his news and his health there, but also some news that did slip under the radar with one of BC's institutions. We'll get to that in just a moment. But if you want to help us deliver these stories, you can check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/westerncontext. And there we offer three tiers of support. For as little as $2 a month, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, or the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, of course, you're probably wondering, where does this go? Well, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article expanding on topical stories of the month, and this article will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of a month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. And we also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well through PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. So with that, we're moving to BC. We're going to talk about the Premier's health a little bit and, of course, the Royal BC Museum.
Yes, indeed. Now, the biggest news out of BC this week is that Premier John Horgan has been diagnosed with throat cancer after a biopsy on a growth on his neck last week revealed that there was some tissue there that was cancerous. Now, he says that his prognosis is good and he expects to make a full recovery as it was caught fairly early, and he will begin radiation treatment soon. In the meantime, Horgan will continue on as Premier, and Deputy Premier Mike Farnworth will step in the event that he is needed to assist with the Premier's duties, and likely we will see him more in person and in press conferences as Horgan battles cancer, and we wish Horgan well in his battle against cancer, and hopefully he has a recovery as such that he can get back to leading the province and to helping the province move through this tough economic and health time. Now, in other BC news this week, it appears that the Royal BC Museum, which is one of downtown Victoria's most popular tourist attractions, and indeed one of the province's most popular attractions, well, it will be getting a facelift on half of its exhibits in an operation that could take years to complete. Now, the museum, which was first operated in 1886, recognizes that some of the displays are an offensive and inadequate representation of Indigenous history, and said that changes are in response to a call to action from Indigenous leaders to, quote, ensure that the museum is a welcome place for everyone. So with these changes, the entire third floor of the museum, known as the First Peoples Gallery, which includes the exhibits Our Living Languages, The First Peoples Voices in BC, and Becoming BC, the Becoming BC Gallery, which focuses on the story of European settlement in BC and in Victoria, has been widely criticized by First Nations for pushing a colonial narrative, and it will be the first to close. The main floor and the second floor natural history and special exhibit galleries will remain open, along with the IMAX Theater, which contains the largest IMAX screen in BC. Now, the Royal BC Museum's acting CEO, Daniel Muzica, who took over for the previous CEO after allegations of racism in the institution from former First Nations staff, well, he sent out a statement explaining the decision, and he said, quote, "Decolonization of the museum's galleries is important and long overdue. This is necessary to begin the long-term work of creating new narratives that include underrepresented voices and reflect the lived experiences and contemporary stories of the people in BC." And that has made it to our quote of the week because it perfectly encapsulates what has been going on in BC and in the larger country as a whole in the last few summers, especially since the Orange Shirt Day and the First Nations remains were discovered at former residential schools over the summer. Now, the announcement is part of the museum's response to calls to action from Indigenous leaders to increase cultural safety and make the museum a welcome place to all. The museum's goal is to reflect the lived experiences of people who live in modern British Columbia, as well as those who have historically lived in the region. Now, Musica said that the process means that the exhibits in the Becoming BC Gallery chronicling early European settler history, which includes the old town replica of what Victoria used to look like, displays on the early logging and fishing industries, and a replica of Captain George Vancouver's ship. George Vancouver, of course, being one of the first English explorers of the region and the coast. Well, his ship Discovery will disappear, but elements of those displays will eventually return in a new form as the museum develops its new narrative. Now, displays on the third floor, such as Old Town and Vancouver Ship, have long been among the museum's most popular since their introduction in the 1960s, but Musica said that the changes are essential to present a more accurate history for generations to come. Now, the First Peoples and Becoming BC Galleries will be closed in phases before being completely shut down on January 2nd, 2022. The museum says that the phased closure will give visitors a chance to view the exhibits as they currently appear. So, as of right now, it's currently unclear what the third floor galleries will be replaced with. The museum says that it will undertake extensive consultations and community outreach before any new exhibits are unveiled, and discussions will include First Nations from across BC, Métis people, and those of the South Asian and Chinese heritage, who all played roles in the province's history. Artifacts that are currently on display will be returned to the museum's collections as the galleries are being closed down. The museum notes that this is not a renovation of the exhibits, but an end to them. Now, the NDP's Minister of Tourism, Melanie Mark, who is the first First Nations woman to serve in cabinet, had harsh words for the museum. She said, quote, "Our government's commitment to truth and reconciliation demands that we diversify and decolonize the way we share the history of BC. For too long, museums have been colonial institutions that exclude others from telling their own stories. We have an opportunity to turn the museum inside out, and it starts here, now, on the museum's third floor." Now, the chief of the local Sartlet First Nation, Don Tom, says that he was surprised by the announcement, that he welcomes the changes and says that it, quote, "addresses some of our concerns about racism at the RBCM. It's a step in the right direction, but there is much work to do. For me personally and the Sartlet, it presents an opportunity to educate the wider population about the real history of BC." Now, the museum has long been regarded as one of the best in Canada, and the decision has caused mixed reaction online, with many recounting favorite parts of the surprisingly lifelike and interactive exhibits. It remains to be seen what narratives the museum will try to tell with their new exhibits, but one thing's for sure, a huge pillar of Victoria will be irrevocably changed forever.
This is a story that raises a lot of questions, and people are going to ask these questions. And one of the first questions that's going to come up is, in terms of the so-called decolonization efforts that the museum wants to undertake, in doing so, in completely redoing or, in fact, closing these exhibits, is there going to be a rewrite of history? And we all know that to have the best understanding of history, it needs to be interpreted with context, in that the history of 1867 Canada, viewed through the lens of 2021 Canada, looks very odd and in many cases can look very racist. But when you apply the 1867 context to that, or any year for any specific piece of history, in doing so, in doing that action, that's what creates the learning experience, and that's what historians often do. Now, we need to be 100% clear in this, that we don't know what the new exhibits are going to look like. We don't know if it's going to be a rewriting of history or if it's going to be a faithful interpretation of history with context as it happens. And if that is the way it goes, great. But anytime we start talking about decolonization, and in particular changing the perception of how history unfolded, it's something that, that people need to be worried about. And at the end of the day, we just need to ensure that the context is there.
Yes, exactly. And I think that context is something that we both believe is should be at the forefront of any discussion when it comes to history or politics, in the sense that you need context to understand what goes on in day-to-day life, but you also need context to understand what happened in the past as well. And I think that the Royal BC Museum has so far created exhibits that really display a narrative that really shows what history has been. Anyone who's been to the museum ever will know that they create displays and interactions with their guests that will really raise the education level of anyone who visits there, regardless of what the exhibit is about. And many of the temporary galleries that have been in place over the years, from the Titanic to ancient Egypt to Leonardo da Vinci, any of them that have been in there will know that many of the kids and school children and teenagers and adults, all who have been there, have taken away some sort of learning experience from the museum. So hopefully in the future, when they decide which narratives they want to tell, it will retain that high standard of quality and will be able to better incorporate all aspects of BC's history, rather than focusing in on what the modern day historians will try to say is the context that is missing when it comes to erasing certain parts of history. And we want to make sure that that continues to happen, is that we still have that context as to what happened back in 1870 when the province first joined Confederation, and when the gold rushes happened in the BC interior, and certainly as BC turned into the powerhouse of Western Canada that it is today. So we hope that the Royal BC Museum will take the right step forward whenever they decide to do it. And, well, we hope that at least some of the popular exhibits that are going to be changed will be reopened again at some point in a slightly different form.
Yeah, and that's what it's all about. And if anything fishy comes up with this, you can bet that this will be part of our story here at Western Context. And we're going to continue to apply that context. We're going to apply that to the flag right now, because since the graves of 215 unexpected children were found at the Kamloops residential school site in May, flags in Canada have been at half-mast. Now, the flag is as important of a national symbol as there is. It is what signifies Canada to the world abroad and acts as a display of national patriotism at home. Canadians, by and large, when traveling abroad, often wear a Canadian flag on their hat or their bags to signify national pride. There has, of course, been a huge myriad of discussion through the election campaign about just when the flag would return to its full stature. We now have a plan for the flag's return. On November 7th, all flags currently at half-mast, in recognition of the victims and survivors of the residential school system, will rise at sunset. They will lower on November 8th for Indigenous Veterans Day, and then be raised and lowered again on November 11th. Following Remembrance Day on November 11th, the flags will be raised again. Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole said that Canada's flag is our most important national symbol, which not only represents our dream for a better country, but our past. It was appropriate to lower the flag to recognize our tragic history of residential schools and the unspeakable trauma it has caused for generations of Indigenous peoples in Canada. In fact, because of the personal conduct of the Prime Minister and the opportunity to raise the flag after the first National Day of Truth and Reconciliation on September 30th was missed. Symbolic acts are not a substitute for concrete action on reconciliation. Some of the other options include raising an orange Every Child Matters flag aside with the Canadian flag. Now, we just need to unpack this a little bit, because Every Child Matters is an interesting slogan, because in thinking about it, do we want each missing child and survivor to just matter? Or do we want them to attain justice and be remembered for their distinct culture and personality? Most people will say the latter, and asking certain groups or certain people to just matter is a cop-out when it could be so much more. The discussion around the flag comes from the same government that on last Friday afternoon announced that they were going to appear in a court case that would have had the government compensate, or appeal a court case rather, that would have had the government compensate Indigenous children. Appealing the case is effectively taking Indigenous children to court. After suffering backlash on this, the government announced that while they would be appealing it, they'd also start the claims process. And with this, if the government acts like this, many will wonder, do they even care? Why are they even making the flag a big deal? Many will ask, why not just raise the same flag on the same pole as the Canadian flag? But that can't be done. There's actually flag protocols within the country that state that the national flag of Canada has to be flown on its own mast or pole, and it's improper to fly two or more flags on the same mast or pole. The government statement on the matter says that as the paramount symbol of our nation, the act of flying the national flag of Canada at half-mast for the longest period of time in Canada's history speaks to the extraordinary sense of loss. This is a profound moment in Canadian history, and it's causing many to take note of the flag, something at which they do not do that often. Part of having a robust country involves a certain level of patriotism, and the flag falls squarely into that. This entire discussion since May is grounds to reopen the flag code and add further clarification about half-mast. Alongside this, the government could also add language clarifying derivative Canadian flags and clarify whether or not they're allowed to be flown in place of the Canadian flag, and there are also other provisions as well that could be discussed. But if anything this year teaches us anything, it should be that there should be at least a discussion on whether or not to limit how long a flag can be flown at half-mast due to a certain event. Now, of course, at the end of the day, we need to remember our veterans, as it was those people fighting for freedom in both World Wars, Korea and Afghanistan, and other conflicts that have had a huge impact on our country. Their sacrifices should not be forgotten or diminished, and we can only hope that 2022 will see a proper space of time between flags being lowered on National Truth and Reconciliation Day and Remembrance Day in November.
Yes, there was a powerful chance to have a statement made on the National Truth and Reconciliation Day on September 30th, which the federal government decided to not make a national holiday, but Trudeau decided to make his own personal holiday by traveling to Tofino, BC, and to take in the sights and walk along the beach with his family and maybe even go for a bit of surfing and water sports that he's known to do. But instead of doing that, he could have taken this solemn opportunity to make a very important cultural statement and an important step in reconciliation with First Nations after a very trying year for everybody in Canada involved, and certainly the opportunity with the flag being raised after Truth and Reconciliation Day, which could have been heralded by an increased solemnity by the government. Well, none of that happened, and instead Trudeau blew off the First Nations chiefs that invited him to talk on Truth and Reconciliation Day, and decided that the best way forward was to keep the flag at half-mast instead, which, as most people would see, as an empty symbol into what the government is doing, especially when you consider the court case that is going on by the federal government that is, you know, to put it simply, is taking Indigenous children to court. So while the government tries to say one thing and then does another completely, we miss the opportunity for reconciliations. And I think that the headline, given where they where the federal government has announced plans to raise and then re-lower the flags, well, it could read something out of a satire website. And I think that's just the bizarre world that we live in 2021, where such a discussion over the flag is such a controversial one, when the flag originally should have been lowered, but the longer it's being lowered for, the less chance there is of an educational moment to take place among the populace. And as we've seen before in the story with the museum, there needs to be context with a story. And if the government isn't providing that context, then it leads to an empty action that in reality doesn't do any more than doing nothing.
And to put this as simple as it can be, a flag at half mast for half a year stops being a symbol. It's lowering the flag on those days of remembrance, all the days of remembrance, that creates the symbol. And the fact the federal government wasn't able to do this, and we had that court case that appeared last Friday again, and we knew that was going to appear sometime after the election, and it got little to no media coverage. That could have been a story this week, but there have been other stories as well that worked so well into this. It really raises the question of just what exactly is going to be the dynamic of the new parliament when it returns on November 22nd, and if either of the opposition parties are going to treat the minority liberals any different as they did in the last parliament. And if they do, then, well, we might have an interesting story to report. But until then, we'll be waiting until November 22nd as the politicians currently return from the COP26 summit in Scotland.
Yes, indeed. That is our firing line story, which is talking about the COP26 summit in Glasgow. And of course, one of the bigger pieces of world news this past week that affects Canada has been the United Nations Climate Change Conference, known as the COP26 summit in Glasgow, Scotland, which is being held between October 31st and November 12th. Now, 25,000 delegates from 200 countries are attending, and this includes about 120 heads of state. Now, Justin Trudeau has been attending, of course, and has attempted to raise Canada's profile among the other nations with his own curious brand of politics. Now, Trudeau announced that Canada will impose a hard cap on emissions from the oil and gas sector, and he said that it was calling the promise a major commitment that it should inspire other resource-rich countries to dramatically curb their own emissions. Trudeau also said that Canada is prepared to limit the growth of one of the country's largest industries to help the world hold the global average temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Trudeau said, quote, "We'll cap oil and gas sector emissions today and ensure that they decrease tomorrow at a pace and scale needed to reach net zero by 2050. That's no small task for a major oil and gas producing country. It's a big step that's absolutely necessary." Now, with this, Trudeau also invoked the memory of Lytton, BC, the small interior BC town that burned to the ground after a wildfire swept through the town in the midst of the giant heat wave that swept through the entire province last summer and caused record-breaking temperatures. Now, Trudeau mentioned Lytton, BC, during his speech as he called for global action in the fight against climate change, and he formally committed to his cap on emissions by Canada's oil and gas sector. He told the assembled leaders, quote, "What happened in Lytton can and has and will happen anywhere. How many more signs do we need? This is our time to step up and step up together." Now, the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, otherwise known as CAP, the lobby group that represents oil and gas interests, has argued that Canada accounts for less than 1.5% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, and global climate change efforts should instead be directed at coal, which still accounts for half of all world emissions. CAP President and CEO Tim McMillan disagrees with Trudeau's announcement that will eventually hobble one of the country's most profitable industries. He said, quote, "Natural gas and oil are Canada's largest export products and a foundational pillar of Canada's economy and innovation capacity, supporting approximately 500,000 jobs and representing about $30 billion in annual economic investment. To achieve the ambitions of the Paris Agreement, the world will need increased access to lower emission natural gas and oil. Canada, under the right policy environment, can position ourselves as a preferred global supplier, creating jobs and prosperity for Canadians and helping to lower global greenhouse gas emissions." But unfortunately for Tim McMillan, it seems that our government is not on board with his vision of being a world supplier of cleaner and ethical gas and oil production. because in a letter to the government's Net Zero Advisory Board, former Greenpeace rooftop stuntman turned environmental minister Stephen Gilbo and former environment minister turned natural resources minister Jonathan Wilkinson both say that they need the board's help to craft the new sector emission cap. In a letter from the both of them, they wrote, quote, "It is essential that as we move to a net zero emissions economy, Canadian workers and communities continue to prosper. Our goal is a future in which the energy workers and communities that helped build this country have an even greater opportunities than they do today through a responsible transition to the low carbon economy." Now, Gilbo said that he doesn't have any details yet on what would happen to a company that goes beyond the cap. He said that the plan is still in development, but was quick to say that John Kerry, who is Biden's special presidential envoy for climate, had expressed interest in the idea. Now, Gilbo has long been an opponent of Canada's oil and gas industry. As we mentioned before, he was a former Greenpeace activist, and shortly after being sworn in as environment minister, he made what amounts to a war declaration to the industry. He said, quote, "Ottawa will cap emissions from the oil and gas sector. We're not doing that with any other sectors, not steel, not the auto industry, forestry, or cement. We're doing it for oil and gas because it represents 25% of emissions in Canada." Now, he says that he's doing it for oil and gas as if it's a favor. Now, Canada's carbon tax is set to become $170 a ton by the end of the decade, despite stiff opposition from the Conservatives, and Trudeau is now trying to get other countries to put a carbon tax in place as well. He floated the idea of establishing a minimum global price on emissions to level the playing field for countries like Canada that have already levied taxes on fuel sources. But it remains to be seen if he has the political capital as well as the force of will to actually bring other countries along into taxing their own industries and their own people. Now, the Canadian tax hike will, however, result in higher costs for consumers when they buy gasoline. The price at the pump will increase by 37.57 cents a liter by 2030 as a result of the $170 a ton tax, and the cost of light fuel oil for home heating, natural gas, and propane will rise as well. And for anyone who's been awake for the past couple weeks, we'll know that inflation has also caused many of these prices to already rise as well already. Now, it remains to be seen what exactly the conference will really accomplish in terms of real action on climate change or on ordinary citizens living around the world. China's Xi Jinping was not attending the conference, and with greenhouse gas emissions by China being the world's largest by far, this makes it less likely that the conference would result in a significant climate deal that will actually do anything. The prime ministers or heads of states of South Africa, Russia, Iran, Mexico, Brazil, and Turkey also did not attend the meeting as well. But never fear, because Elizabeth May, the Green Party's on-again, off-again leader, had descended to attend the conference with her fellow Green MPs, which consists of just herself and Mike Morris, the MP of Kitchener Centre. She decided to take a train from London to Glasgow instead of a plane, just to show how much more environmentally friendly her travel was. Nevertheless, still taking a plane flight from Victoria all the way over to London in the first place. And speaking of the travel, well, delegates traveling to Glasgow in private jets were accused of hypocrisy by commentators and campaigners. Around 400 private jets arrived in Glasgow for the talks, making journeys which would mostly have been completed using scheduled flights. Event planners, however, insisted that the conference would be carbon neutral, but many are skeptical. Now, U.S. President Joe Biden is thought to be the worst offender of the private jet emissions, as Air Force One and the four other large jets that accompany him will generate almost 1,000 tons of CO2 during his round trip to Europe. In addition, the president traveled to Edinburgh Airport to the summit in Glasgow in a motorcade of 22 cars, creating around 4 tons of CO2 for the 150-kilometer round trip. The president's armored limousine, which is nicknamed the Beast, also manages just 8 miles per gallon and emits 4 kilograms of CO2 per mile. In contrast, a hybrid family car emits around just 0.12 kilograms per mile. So with all this, one wonders if the climate conference will actually reduce more CO2 and create lasting change on the climate. But, well, we'll see if they actually reduce more CO2 than its attendees have emitted in just getting to Glasgow and back.
And that's the thing with these international gatherings. They all fly in on their jets, and in doing so, they talk. But we all know, and this is at least what the prevailing idea of wisdom is in terms of coming up with international treaties, is that to have a successful international treaty, you need to have all of the major players there. But with large countries like China, India, and Russia not committing fully to this, it largely becomes a focus on the Western nations. And a lot of people who run their cars every day and are just trying to get through day-to-day life with the inflation, as we mentioned and have been talking about a lot recently on the podcast, a lot of these people would rather see that kind of money spent that's being spent on climate, on programs that are going to help them out at the end of the day instead. And we can, of course, have a discussion on climate, and that's a discussion that needs to happen as to how greenhouse gas emissions are lowered, whether it's through nuclear or other means in that way. But at the end of the day, we have to remember that the thing that our leaders, our world leaders, are accountable to are the people who elected them. And if they're not paying attention to that, then they're not serving those people, and they deserve to be shown the boot at the next election. And we'll just have to wait and see what Stephen Gilbo and his band of friends wants to do with the Alberta energy industry, because that's going to be a huge discussion going forward when that legislation comes up in Parliament as well.
Yes, exactly. The Liberal Party did just get a few more MPs in Alberta. So this attack on Alberta's main industry will remain to be seen what will happen to those MPs, if they will get shown the door as they did after the 2017 election. And certainly what happens in Canada will come down in large part as to what the government wants to do with its own industries. And there is a fine balancing act here at play, in the sense that the government won't want to completely shut down the oil and gas sectors. And if they want to do that, they certainly can't, because a lot of them have the jurisdiction with the provinces. So likely the federal government will try to blame a lot of the emissions on the provinces that have control of its own natural resources. And well, that's another game that's been played since time immemorial between the federal government and the provincial governments, taking blame or assigning blame based on the different jurisdictions. But as it comes to the world at large, we'll see whether this climate conference actually does any lasting action, as the some of the biggest emitters didn't even bother to show up. And certainly a lot of the ones that did bother to show up were taking a lot of time in their private jets to waste a lot of energy just getting there in the first place. And we, of course, mentioned President Joe Biden with Air Force One and the Beast. But there's certainly many other examples of this. And, even Britain's own Boris Johnson was arrived at the conference via an electric bus, but he decided to take a private plane back to London after the conference is over because of time constraints. So, you know, one plane is neither here nor there when it comes to a total country's emissions, but whether this conference will actually get countries on board to reduce those emissions is another thing entirely. And I think that when it comes down to it, the news being pervaded with this story throughout the entirety of the week so far is just really distracting what else has been going on in Canada.
Yeah, that's entirely true. And that's the whole reason the podcast exists. And, you know, we do have a good word of the week and quote of the week and all the other fun stuff as well. And our word, I think, can apply to mainly the BC story, but we might be able to stretch to other stories as well this week.
Yeah, so word of the week this week is decolonization, which we mentioned, of course, very heavily in the Royal BC Museum story. It is, of course, described as the action or process of a state withdrawing from a former colony, leaving it independent. And, of course, in Canada, it now refers to the action of erasing the remnants of European colonial history. And certainly, we've seen a lot of decolonization efforts when it comes to statues being removed or names being changed. And now we're seeing the latest trend of that with the museum deciding to change its exhibits. And decolonization, you could mention, is in talks with the flag story as well, with the options of raising an orange Every Child Matters flag alongside the Canadian flag. That could be decided as a effort of decolonization, but certainly the proposals that are out there are surprising to many, and certainly we will keep an eye on these things going forward.
That's right. And if you want to read up all about all of these stories, you can find them in the show notes at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there. We're on Apple Podcast, Google, Pocket Cast, and more. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, you can also find us on social media, on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we share some of the stories we look at, and of course, these podcasts. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll be sure to look through all the stories that the media is talking about and a lot that they aren't talking about in discovering what's really going on in the country, in BC and Alberta, and even perhaps the world at large. We will find them, whether they're on radio, TV, print, or online. We will give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.